I'd like to welcome you to Science and Technology for In Service to the Poor. My name is Stanton Greer, and I'll be moderating and introducing everyone. And our first speaker this afternoon is Dr. Steve Bradley.
Okay, I appreciate y'all coming to this session. There's one special guest in the session that I've never had to speak to before, and it's my mom. So I don't know if any of you guys have ever had to speak with your mom in the audience, but that's a little different. So the other thing that's different is I'm from the business school, as you've noticed, and I know most of y'all are scientists. I'm a former engineer. I guess I could still call myself an engineer, and I had to, when I moved in the business world, I had to accept the idea that social science is actually a science. So hopefully you can accommodate that. But I've had the privilege of working with some of the people in the next talks that you'll hear. And I think what might be of value here is to think about stepping back from the actual technologies that are being developed to help alleviate poverty and look at some of the economics of it and try to ask some questions about, what technology should we be looking at? Why do some work and why do some not work? And so mine is kind of a bigger picture look at the forest of the economics of this and bring up some questions and think about what are some key components as we look at some of these technologies. So the first thing I did was just starting with, as we all know, everybody's talking about sustainable development. You know, people are wanting to, if we're going to go into countries, you know, we want to do it in a way that provides for the long-term future needs of future generations, not just meeting some current situation or economic standard. And so people have come up with some different definitions of that. This is probably the one that's the most common because it's the one used by the UN. But it's basically development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet those needs. So people are looking and saying, is there social sustainability? Is it something that is bearable by the culture? Is it environmentally sustainable? And then lastly, is it economically sustainable? And I'll be focusing mostly on that. Now, when we talk about sustainability, one of the things we always think about when that word comes up in the business world is we think about sustainable competitive advantage. So one of the key areas of research in our field is the resource-based view. And basically, a sustainable competitive advantage is gained by possessing valuable, rare, or inimitable resources that allow a firm or a country or anybody to maintain that advantage over a longer period of time. And so that's a different way to think about sustainability, is not just, is it something that's ecologically friendly, but is it something that allows a country to have enough time to kind of get on their feet and to gain some advantage, or at least a comparable equity with the rest of the world. And so that's kind of what we're looking at in this talk. Now, you know, if you look back and at the history of some of the other development attempts, you know, typically they've been top-down. You know, foreign direct investment has been encouraged. If it isn't government aid, maybe it's from multinational companies that have tried to come in. And typically, a lot of what's been done is one of two things. It's either been foreign direct investment to extract resources that were maybe temporarily valuable. There's something that was depleted pretty quickly. The second thing would just be low-cost labor. You know, typically, if we think of developing countries, the main advantage they have is that they have labor that's lower cost than other countries. And so, ironically, those two things end up being used up. Either a country, eventually their wages rise as people use production facilities there. In fact, I've heard China is now starting to outsource some of their labor to, if not to, you know, far Western China, you know, even to other countries, because China's labor is starting to rise. So you'll see that type of an advantage that developing countries have initially is not sustainable. Other approaches, bottom-up approaches, you know, a lot of people said, well, the key problem in these developing countries is they don't have capital. You know, Hernando de Soto and others have argued that if people just had capital available, that would create this whole rise of entrepreneurs that could go out and start businesses develop the country. Now, I've been working on a project this summer with a
a microcredit agency in the Dominican Republic. And one of my suspicions was that almost any business that any of these people do is going to be completely replicative of what everyone else is doing. And so we went down and did some surveying there in the Dominican Republic. And the only thing this credit agency doing is get $50 loan, $200 loan. What we found was, in our surveying, everyone was copying exactly what everyone else was doing. And we would ask them, like, do you try to innovate or change your business the way you sell your product compared to your competitor? They didn't even know what we were talking about. I mean, they just find out what the guy on the next corner is selling it for, and they sell it for the exact same price. Don't try to alter the color, nothing. And so my concern, and I think microcredit's done a lot, and you've heard a lot about it in the news. You know, somebody was given a Nobel Prize for it, so it's obviously done some good. But I think the problem is not everybody's an entrepreneur. Many of the people in these countries don't even have any sense of innovation at all. And so a lot of what's happening is profit margins are being driven down to zero because you're getting 20 or 30 people selling the exact same product within a one-mile radius. So we haven't finished looking at the surveys, but that's one of the problems. Okay, so the question is, if we say we need some unique resources, you know, how do we develop this sustainable advantage? Do any of these developing countries have resources that might be available? And if they are there, why are they not maximized? What's prevented that from being taken advantage of historically? What's been the problem there? And you know, lastly, can it be something that's done to alleviate poverty? Okay, comparative advantage is a term that was used by Ricardo. It goes back to kind of some early economic theory, but it basically explains why we outsource labor. You know, it says, for example, if you have somebody that is the best attorney in town, and they would also just happen to be the best secretary in town, would they maximize their value by doing both of those jobs? Well, of course not, you know, because attorneys are paid, you know, 10 times what maybe a secretary is paid. So it would be good to divide that labor and to split those up. And then overall, both economies benefit, if you think about it in terms of economies, not just two people. But what might happen for a developing country, and so typically what happens for the developing country is they end up being like the secretary or administrative assistant, where they get the low-cost job, and you know, the developed country gets the higher paying job. But what can change that is if there is some type of a resource advantage that allows a country to basically get the higher margin position for an extended period of time. Okay, so some examples of this might be things like sugarcane and ethanol production in Brazil. You know, sugarcane doesn't grow everywhere. And it has an advantage over the type of ethanol fuels that we're trying to develop here in the U.S. It grows much more quickly. I think the production per pound of sugarcane is much better than corn. Some other examples, even things like flowers, the very unique types of plants in the Andes that only grow in certain high-altitude regions of the world, have very value-added medical benefits. And then lastly, one that we'll hear about in a few minutes is this coconut project, which has gotten a lot of publicity, at least here at Baylor. Now, if you look at a product like coconuts, you see a ton of products that might be made from this, and we'll hear about some more of these later. But the question is, if there's all of these different products, why are they often not, in many countries, why are those not found? And one of the things that's one of the things that we're looking at. Now, if you think about how do we define what a coconut is, or even if we think of a current topic, how do we define what a car is right now? You know, there's a social construction to what we mean when we talk about a car. I mean, if you think about, I have a family with four kids, so to me a car is a Suburban, okay? But you have these other constraints, and typically in a free market society, we're thinking the market end user is the one defining what the product is. It's what the people want. But you have these other actors involved in defining what a product is. For example, you might have the car producers saying, no, this is where we're headed with what production is. And right now we have regulations where we've got this Cars for Clunkers program saying, no, what we want for a car now is something much smaller. So we're going to put pressure in trying to define what this artifact, if it's an automobile. But you could think about that for any type of a product. So you can think in a country, in some countries you'd hear coconuts are simply for, you know, drilling a hole and sticking a straw in it and selling it on the street to a tourist. Okay, and then you go to other countries and you find out, oh no, you know, we carve the meat out and there's, you know, these all these different things we can use it for. And so country by country, what a coconut is has been defined by these different actors. Now, if you look across several countries where coconuts are grown and you look at these different, and this is very general, you look at the producers, if they have trade support, maybe there's regulation involved in that industry, and then you look at the end users, and what you find is that in countries where you have very low-skilled producers, the trade support's not very high. In other words, there's not a trade association promoting coconut products. Maybe regulation is quite high. End users maybe are only very local. You find that there's very few products developed out of that. So the way coconuts are understood, or any product, is a function of all of these different actors over time helping to define that. Okay, so we have this issue of dispersed knowledge. Hayek, who's, you know, a famous economist, basically said that nobody holds complete knowledge on any product. I mean, nobody knows all the value of what coconuts are. Or, you know, we don't have complete knowledge of why markets work the way they do, because all that knowledge is held by different actors. Some of them know more than others, but it's dispersed. It's something that's held collectively by all of us. And so the problems with that is that if there's large numbers, if there's large pieces of information, it requires a lot of attention to try to understand what's going on, either in a market or, you know, for a product or a production process. The second thing is there's asymmetries. In other words, some people know certain things, other people know other things about a product, and sometimes what we know is very much dependent on our own history. You know, so if we grow up in a certain country, we have certain set of knowledge pieces. People that grow up in other countries have different knowledge pieces. And then lastly, just uncertainty. A lot of times, even if we know what information is, it's hard to collectively put that together to know how to use it. Okay, and that's particularly a problem for people in developing countries where, you know, they have very limited markets, technologies are pretty rudimentary, and maybe there's either no competition, so you can observe and see how other people are using a product, or everybody's doing the same thing as we've seen in the Dominican Republic. Okay, so the problem with having these imperfect markets is that people are very limited in their decision-making ability. You know, they have very little knowledge. You know, the markets are very incomplete, and this uncertainty leads to very high transaction costs. So it's interesting, I wasn't aware of this till I was putting this talk together, that even in the U.S., over 45% of the national income was devoted just to transacting. And what that means is that just in terms of contracts and trying to make arrangements to trade products in a way that's fair to both parties, a big portion of our income is actually used up, in a sense, non-productively, because it's basically just to make the exchange happen. So you can imagine what that would be in developing countries where you don't have rule of law, you have a lot of corruption. So what ends up happening is you have people selling very non-innovative products that they're not going to invest a lot in. If you're living in a place where the economy is so underdeveloped, there's such corruption, you're not going to go spend $1 million building a factory that somebody could come take from you, or it's vandalized. So people end up selling things that are very low labor-intensive type products. Okay, again, another problem is the problem of institutions. In the countries that I just mentioned previously, you can see that in many of these countries, just happens to be with the coconuts, they are very low in terms of their economic freedom, and that can be across a variety of things like trade, government size, relation to the income of the country, property rights, corruption. So you can see those compared to the U.S., who's fifth and probably falling rapidly. This was from, 2008 and 2006. Okay, so we asked this question. We said, if we could find a unique resource and it was something that would provide a sustainable advantage for a small group of people or even a whole country, depending on how much the product was pervasive in that country, what pieces would need to be in play to make that happen? Okay, so if we're trying to come up with a way to incorporate sustainable development, you know, we have the resource. What other pieces need to be in place? And the thing that we came up with, at least, you know, as a baseline, are social entrepreneur, the indigenous entrepreneur, and the institutions. And I'll talk about these for a second. Okay, institutions, of course, are important because they're basically the rules of the game. Douglas North has said that, you know, these institutions are important because they create property rights, rule of law, they allow for competitive markets, and they encourage entrepreneurship or innovation. And they also reduce the transaction costs that we talked about. Okay, now I mentioned that dispersed knowledge could actually be a problem, but in a way, if you go back and look at it, it actually can be an advantage. And I think this is really where some of the people that you're going to hear talks from in a second have done some very creative things, is they've basically gone into countries and said, what resources do you have here that we could, you know, help you take advantage of? And what they were able to do was the social entrepreneur was able to step back and say, yeah, you have this limited knowledge of what coconuts are for. Maybe you only understand that the coconuts are for the inside. You know, here's this husk that people are throwing away. What could we do with that? Maybe there's some new technology. Those are pieces of knowledge or information that the local indigenous entrepreneur would never have. And so the social entrepreneur can bring these new technologies. They might bring sources of capital from the West or from other locations, even from within country. They bring potential export markets that might have been unavailable to the local producer. And they might also be able to arrange contracts in a way that benefit as many workers as possible. Okay, so the social entrepreneur brings some whole new external value that was not there before. The indigenous entrepreneur is clearly important because if somebody comes in, if somebody from a Western country or from an outside country comes in and just tries to basically force a new technology, and we've seen examples of this throughout history where people have tried to come in and do good, but they don't understand the local cultures, they don't understand how to work with the local government. Often they're very unsuccessful despite the fact that they're providing all of these value-added things. They have to have the indigenous entrepreneur. And then lastly, the institutional actors play a role in helping both of these agents fulfill their role. And this could be anything like, you know, a coconut production association, or somebody that's working from the government side to be able to work with these actors. Okay? So what we're looking at right now is we've been working with some of the people here at Baylor in the technology area, looking and trying to say, what is the feasibility of some of the business projects that we're working on here at Baylor, both the hydroelectric, we work with that group, as well as some of the coconut production. How do agents or actors help shape the institutions that would further the sustainable development? So, for example, if there was an example in Africa where cocoa farmers were basically given loans by the government to grow cocoa, but then they were forced to sell the cocoa to the government at a fixed price. Okay, so the government had complete control. They said, you need our money to be able to grow the product, but you can only sell it to us at a price that we're going to determine. But what happened over time was that these cocoa farmers became more wealthy, and then they started being able to influence the board and determine what the more fair or market price should be. And so in some ways, the actors can start to shape the institutions that normally had previously controlled them. So how does that occur? You know, can the social entrepreneur, the person that's bringing value-added capital or ideas or knowledge from outside help to shape the institutions that have normally kind of really held down opportunities in country. And what arrangements can the indigenous and social entrepreneurs make that will minimize hazard? And by that I mean, there's been some examples, some of these are things that I've heard from people working, for example, in Armenia, where somebody comes in and gives money to start a cabinet-making company or a countertop company, and this one person becomes fabulously wealthy, but really passes none of that along to all the people that are working with them. And so if the social entrepreneur has a goal of trying to really alleviate poverty for the most people possible, they could do some creative things like, rather than just paying cash that's either easily stolen or used by one person, you say, well, we're going to provide a school or educational vouchers or in-kind products that can't be easily stolen or transferred. So then that way you can reduce the moral hazard. And then lastly, just qualitatively and quantitatively, how do we measure some of these things? How do we measure changes in performance? So those are some things that we're thinking about from the business side. And, I know most of you are probably here thinking more on the technology side, but I think it is very important to think about what's the feasibility. If we're really talking about sustainability of some of these technologies, there's got to be a business component to it that makes sense. Okay, so I'll finish there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? This is very theoretical at this point, so.
I was just curious, the transaction costs 45% in 1970. I gather from your talk, you think that may be going down, but I wonder if it's perhaps going up.
Well, yeah, that was from North's book, and I guess they had looked at that, a while back. I don't know which direction it's gone, but that's an interesting question.
I'm just thinking about the legal environment now versus 1970.
Right.
A lot more.
Right. Well, as things become more litigious, as the government laws become more complex, the transaction costs are going to go up. There's a number of factors. In an underdeveloped country where, there's a lot of corruption. I mean, I wouldn't say we have a lot of corruption here as compared to these countries. The reason for transaction costs being high would be for different reasons. It might be literally paying for security. We were doing these development of coconut production facilities in some of the countries, and one of the factors we had to include was 24-hour security guards for very rudimentary equipment. And that didn't even dawn on us until somebody else pointed that out to us. It's like, yeah, you need a fence and a security guard. And we're like, to protect a machine that grinds up coconuts. But, it's in many countries that's the case. So that could be a part of the transaction cost.
Do you have an idea what the transaction cost from those other countries would be?
I don't, but I'll try to find that out and let you know. It's a good question. But I would think if it's that high in the U.S., it's going to be much, much higher.
Go to the hardware store and buy a hammer, and they had to have, I think, four or five different employees touch it. And my thought was, man, Home Depot's a lot more. And then I realized, well, they're countering theft here. That's what they're doing.
Right.
They're making it from employees and customers both.
Right. So ultimately, that cost is passed on to the hammer purchaser, isn't it? So corruption, whether it's paying bribes to get some kind of a permit or whatever it is, those costs make many of these countries very unfeasible in terms of their ability to be competitive. So if we could reduce those transaction costs either through institutions or creating, alternative informal institutions. I mean, most of y'all, if you've read at all about microfinance, you heard about the group accountability system that they use. And that was really probably the major innovation of microfinance. It said, normally we... banks guarantee their capital by collateralizing the loan, right? We have to put up something for them to be willing to, so that in case they can't get their money back, they can recapture that somehow. And they came up with this group accountability system where basically if you bail out of a loan, you're making about 20 other people in your community mad, and they're going to have to pay for you. So it created this kind of a unique accountability or social collateral is really what it is. So there may be other ways that if the government, I like the bottom-up approaches because trying to think about how to change corrupt governments is, that just seems to be an intractable problem. But if there's ways to develop, bottom-up approaches that come up with these other types of informal institutions that allow you to do things and work with people, then I think that's probably the more immediate approach. Anybody else have a couple more? This is the CVS Walgreens battle. A lot of times, eventually the market's going to take care of that because eventually one of those two will lose, and then we'll have hundreds of empty stores across the street from the one that won. So what those will become, I don't know. But it's a problem. Ideally, people would think of something innovative and different that's actually needed by the community, rather than doing something that replicates what the other person's doing. But it's a good point. Did you have a comment?
Yeah. If a lot of the transaction costs are coming because of some sort of corruption or problem of that nature, what role would you see Christian theology or Christianity playing in trying to
Right. No, I think it's a great point. I think that churches, and in fact a lot of this microfinance work that's being done is being done, either influenced by churches promoting it. So I think that, in many of these countries where corruption's been endemic, I think the church has can play a leading role and providing some security in some of these transactions. If people know that some of the parties involved are either monitored by, or it's a church-based microfinance program, or it's a coconut co-op that's somehow run by the church. Clearly churches have people that are corrupt in them as well, but I think it probably would lower transaction costs to some degree because people have greater security that their money would be secure. So I think that's a good point, that there is definitely a role for the church or people of faith to be involved in this, because in many countries those may be the only people that people trust, or we'd hope so. Okay.